Welcome, everybody. Welcome to our second episode of the Ungagged Film Club. This month, I was looking for a kind of summer blockbuster because it's, well, summer. And it certainly feels like summer today because we're all melting. So we chose Starship Troopers, the 90s classic.
In every age, there is a cause worth fighting for. But in the future, the greatest threat to our survival will not be man at all.
Hey, kid, what's going on? It's war! We're going to war!
Now, the youth of tomorrow must travel across the stars to defend our world.
We are a generation commanded by fate to defend humankind.
Everyone fights, no one quits.
We are going in with the first wave. You smash the entire area. You kill anything that has more than two legs. You get me?
We get you, sir.
But they will face an enemy more devastating than any ever imagined.
Incoming!
Mayday, mayday, this is Roughneck Tuesday Order.
Commander Tessa, we need retrieval now.
Someone made a damn mistake.
The bugs laid a trap for us, didn't they?
Prepare for battle and journey to the front lines of the next frontier.
Kill them all!
Starship Troopers.
I remember seeing this film when I went to the pictures to see it when I was a teenager, and I'm as baffled by this film now as I was then. So I'd be interested to see what everybody else thinks of it. Joining this week, we've got the wee ginger sociologist, Brian Finlay. Anybody that listens to Hollywood Ungagged will know Brian.
Hello. We'll
also get Mulgai's digital Michelangelo, Deborah Torrens, who, again, if you're a regular listener to Hollywood Ungagged, you'll know Deborah.
Yeah.
And we've got a guest appearance this week is Scott McDonald from Edinburgh Radical Independence Campaign. I've known Scott for many years, and this is not the first conversation about movies we'll have, but it is the first one that we'll have recorded, so we'll see if it is
clear. Hello, everyone.
Thank you well. Hi, Scott. Welcome. So what was everybody's thoughts there in this film? Just kind of initial, I think, Brian, you said that this was, you hadn't seen Starship Troopers before. No. So it'd be good to get first impressions for yourself.
First of all, like, films like Starship,
Blame the Heat.
I blame the heat. It is the heat. Anyway, films like this, not normally my number one choice. Sci-fi films, action films. And I was baffled watching that. I had no idea what was going on for the first wee half an hour, and then you can start to sort of identify some themes that were coming through. But they're not as obvious as I think that what, I don't know whether it was intended or not, but it was interesting, shall we say. Not my number one choice of types of films, but I was fully engaged for the full 2 hours.
Deborah, initial thoughts. Had you seen it before?
Yes, I love a sci-fi. I'd already seen this a couple of times. It always surprises me that it was made in 1997 because I always associate it as an 80s sort of, like it's got an 80s vibe to me, just the whole way it's sort of presented and the actors as well, but we'll get to that. Just first impressions, you need to see it. That's the only way to describe the film in a succinct manner. It's definitely a one-off.
Is it? Hey, Scott, I think you're a bit of a big fan of Starship Troopers based on previous conversations.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, this is, I'm not sure it's like it's unique, like Deborah was saying. I mean, if anybody's seen Paul Verhoeven's previous Robocop, it shares a lot of spiritual and mechanical screenwriting, and it shares a lot of the film mechanics of such a thing. It's got, regularly blasting at propaganda, and both in Robocop, it's the media breaks, it's the kind of little segues that intersperse the plot to provide exposition, and also to provide very, 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 very funny, little spicy moments just to kind of remind you that you're in the future, and this is how things are in this thing. Like, I mean, the thing that struck me most about Troopers this time around is just how incredibly that it was it's remarkably, I mean, I've read interviews with Verhoeven before that he said that he was heavily influenced by the films of Leni Riefenstahl, the Nazi documentarian. And she made a spectacular and horrifying movie called The Triumph of the Will, which is basically about the rise of the Third Reich and basically all how the rallies that Adolf Hitler had for lots and lots of people. And you can see a lot of that same visual and cinematic language throughout the film. You can see the kind of how she photographs these beautiful Aryan people, these kind of and how they, you know, how they go about themselves. You'll see visual riffs on it throughout the movie. It's really obsessed. It's kind of, the movie is kind of a little bit obsessed by how about some kind of fascist utopia of how, I mean, you look at the earth, there's no crime. What's it? That's beautiful. It's gleaming. The palaces of steel and glass. Everybody looks beautiful. It's kind of it kind of tips its hat right at the end with all of its with, yes, this is propaganda. We want you to sign up, you know, troops right at the end. But there's a lot of stuff in there that's very, very, I mean, it's the plot is very kind of Beverly Hills 90210 meets a Vietnam War film, but bloody hellfire. It's kind of full on.
Yeah. You know? What I always think about Starship Troopers is I think it's a really smart film that tries as hard as possible to portray itself as a stupid film. Because I remember when I went to see it when I was like 15, and I just thought this is just going to be a big kind of action-y explosive. And then I kept just seeing all these wee sort of side part things that we'd put in, you know, about like, you know, the murder trial at the last 10 seconds, the way the kind of casual violence that they dish out. And I just remember thinking, why that? And it was never a focus of the story either, which fascinated me. It would show you this a wee hint of some really interesting, and then go right back to the big insects and the terrible love triangles all over the place.
I mean, there's a bit in the third act, you know, like where for this kid, Carl, whatever his name is.
Sorry. David, you need to do a spoiler warning.
Not aware, this is a full spoiler discussion. If you've not seen the film and you don't want to know what happens in it, don't listen to this just now. Save it, go to Disney Plus. I think it's on YouTube as well for some reason. So maybe catch it there for free before it disappears, and then come back and listen to this. So we'll press ahead now with as many spoilers as possible.
There's a bit like in the third act where one of the kids who had just graduated from high school, remember, he's a teenager, walks out in a full-blown SS uniform, completely big chunky boots and a wide shoulder ankle length Nazi jacket. It's kind of it's really on the nose, but I think like you, David, when you were talking about how this kind of little nudges and winks here and there. Some of it's pretty full on, you know, like it's all on the surface. There's almost nothing. I mean, it's all there in the text, if it makes any sense. I mean, it's all really on the nose. But I think most American critics at the time completely missed this stuff and how it lampoons the paraphernalia and pornography inherent in fascist propaganda. I mean, teachers give speeches on the failures of democracy and why only the veterans can vote. You know, there's a big, big quote in itself. I won't do it just now, but naked forces resolve more conflicts throughout history than any other factor. You know, the contrary opinion that violence doesn't solve anything is wishful thinking at its worst. These guys are believing, total believing fascists. I mean, I can sometimes quite sympathise extensively with critics who miss the subtext, even if it's really, really blatant, like in Troopers. Because, I mean, when you watch 6 to 8 movies a week and have to write something on every single one of them, I mean, shoving the subtext aside up does happen. And I appreciate that even for professional, like people that have to get the stuff out. The thing about it is it's kind of an oddly seductive picture. I mean, it normalises the horrors inherent in a gleaming fascist fantasy, but it's also really funny, you know, watching them completely mess this stuff up and they're all fed to the Imperial meat grinder with a much more cunning enemy who know their ground. I mean, it's kind of sexy and weird in a lot of ways. There's kind of a gleeful obsession with the physical. You know, the sparse pretty sets, the huge ships and the bodies, you know, like all other shiny and perfect are completely broken. You know, it's, I mean, the troopers are exercised and drill sergeants tear them apart, break the bones and skewer them into a wall. The showering, you know, it's where Verhoeven himself directed this in the nude. They're all gleaming, beautiful people getting chomped, torn to bits and melted before our eyes. I mean, you kind of compare it to other 1997 films like The Fifth Element or The Lost World. I mean, Verhoeven's kind of slick, cartoony effort feels prescient as hell. You know, if you look at this stuff, and there's a kind of a thick soup of propaganda, war, foreign relations policy, you know, just been absolutely lampooned. And that's long before, and it was about 4 years before 9/11, but you can see all the various elements of this stuff. You know, the Buenos Aires attack was out of nowhere, but it was kind of like 9/11. But you also see the Gulf War when Bosnia was in the past. But the presence is kind of scary. The war and terror parallels are plenty in this picture, I think. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's a lot. I've put a lot on the table there.
Yeah, we'll try to unpick some of that. Yeah, the point I was kind of making is, like you said, a lot of it is quite on the nose, but it doesn't really focus on that, like the whole civilian citizen thing that it brings up right at the start. It then doesn't really, it's not really a plot point. In most films, you'd expect that's going to be like something really important later on, and it's in the background and it motivates the characters, but it doesn't really affect the sort of overall story, which is more about this, you know, soppy love story and how they all learn to love fascism and killing.
When you brought up the sets there, I liked the range of sets and the different sort of locations. I thought that was a really nice aspect to the film. When you were talking about them being in high school, these are some really beautiful looking people that, you know, that end up in a mixed sex communal shower that, you know, they're supposed to be these hormonal sort of fueled people. Yeah, that's really a casual open thing in this sort of fascist society, I found. You know, there was lots of nice contrasts like that. But my favourite thing about the film was the foreshadowing. There was so many points where a character would say something like, oh, I'd rather get 10 lashes. And then later on, poor Rico, he gets 10 lashes, you know, nicely called administrative punishment.
What an Orwellian phrase. Forgetting the skin lashed off your back.
And I agree with you, Scott. You can clearly see the influences that the director had when they drop the little shuttle pod from, you know, the bigger ship, and she's flying through that sort of the other spaceship, and she's doing all those sort of moves. It was very, I hate to say it, but there was some Star Wars vibes in that section. And I really, really appreciated the CGI and the actual physical props that went on. There was a lot of slime in this movie. A lot of gunch. It was good.
Yeah, it's quite Star Trek in the way a lot of the, you know, the shiny starships and the shiny uniforms and things like that, but then completely not Star Trek because it's, you know, fascist and violent, and you could not imagine Captain Picard making that speech about praising the use of violence as a way of solving issues.
And as well, I particularly enjoyed Denise Richards being in this film, because Denise Richards is normally typecasted as particular types of roles, and she's always quite, in some of her roles, is quite detached from reality, and this is very much what this character was about. Very similar to Becky Lehman in the kind of Drop Dead Gorgeous that she plays. So I just thought, like, it's true, like, aesthetically really, really beautiful, but almost vacant at the same time. And you know how they're sort of going through life and getting, you know, so high up into the military because she's so good at maths and all these types of things, and it's almost like becomes a competition, and they all end up in different layers of the military. They end up sort of separating in different areas, which I just think is really, really fascinating.
Yeah, I remember one of the things that surprised me when you look at the kind of main characters is, and I don't know if this again is a really clever thing buried deep in this movie or if it was just the 90s, that all those characters, not one of them, I think, is Latino, and they're all supposed to be from Buenos Aires, and they've all got names like Carmen Ibanez and things like that.
Yep, and they're all Latinos, and there's hardly a single brown person in the entire school.
Well, I started looking, there's a few background characters, because I started thinking, is this a really deep thing implying that there was some kind of genocide? But then there is quite a lot of kind of non-white characters, but they just, none of them are particularly prominent.
And is that, I don't know if that in itself is intentional, because if there was just, you know, characters of colour, but they're not, you know, at the centre of any story, is that, you know, so this is what I kind of mean at the start, right, where for me there were so many different themes and ideas being explored in it, but you don't know which ones, this is me personally, only seen the film once, what is the most prominent narratives that they're trying to sell, you know, because I think Robocop's a lot more obvious, right? Again, I've not seen this for a long time, but I have seen Robocop, and I think it's a lot more obvious as to what it is that they're, what story they're trying to sell, whereas this one, because there's different levels of humour, gore, storytelling, propaganda, all these different things, and you're like, what am I? This is like 2 hours of just all this information just being, sorry, it's just rapid fired at me. And I'm not one for like big action scenes. See the big bit, like, you know, the Star Wars thing flying through. I was just like, oh, come on.
Did you like that? Just,
there's a lot of loud things. it's not really my cup of tea. I'm not really Star Wars or Star Trek or any of these things. But I was like watching it going, I imagine that's what Star Trek's like, or I imagine that's what Star Wars like. I just don't watch them. But I could identify some of these sort of like, you know, correlations or whatever you want to call them to all these really big things. But anyway, yeah, I find it really difficult to sort of identify exactly what was the dominant narrative that and story that they were trying to sell.
And I think that is quite a common thing with Starship Troopers, because I think, 25 years nearly after it came out, people are still debating what it meant, and not only what it meant, what it intended. And I'm still not sure. Like I said, when I watched this again and I tried to really focus and analyse it a bit more, I found I was over-analysing things, like I said, and looking into every wee thing. I was suddenly having a revelation, thinking, oh, maybe they meant this, like maybe they're implying some kind of Holocaust. And then I noticed enough non-white extras that I thought, well, that kind of sinks that. But then something else I noticed was saying that despite this, you know, fascist society, they seem to have moved beyond sexism. You kind of mentioned it earlier, yeah. Deborah. You know, there's no kind of issue with the fact that people are sharing communal showers. You would normally expect, I remember when the character Adiz, when she arrives to join the unit and ends up challenging the sergeant, there's no sort of, oh, you fight like a girl sort of thing or anything you would normally expect in that kind of military atmosphere or military movie. Yeah, and she does better than the big kind of blonde farm boy that casually gets his arm snapped and he's just like, yeah, my biggest problem, sir. Sorry, sir.
This is a good point to talk about the drill sergeant, because I think he's a great character all throughout the film.
One of my favourite sort of character actors, certainly, Clancy Brown.
Oh, Hill Clancy Brown, yeah.
When he says, pain is all in the mind, and the poor guy's got an open fracture in his forearm. Like, I thought that was really funny. And then I really liked him. I thought he was a great character. And the woman you were talking about, Dizzy, that's another great character that sort of came to a sad demise.
She completely pursues Johnny. Like, there's no sense of, oh, I wish he would make the first move. She's like, she's single-minded as any of the bugs in her pursuit. And she eventually succeeds. So she dies happy.
All these gorgeous gleaming people, you know, Casper Van Dien. You know, this movie probably wouldn't have worked half as well if they'd cast better actors in the key roles, to my mind. You know, Casper Van Dien, he's kind of beautiful. He's got shoulders and abs that you could with great cheese on. A jaw that you could slice with a set square. You know, Denise Richards, again, wide-eyed, gorgeous, open, you know, and performs it really. I mean, she kind of, Verhoeven cast her well, because she knows, because like we were saying before, Brian, it's all in how people look in this picture, to my mind. You know, the nerdy Neil Patrick Harris, you see him at the end of the movie where he's kind of trying to read the mind of the brain bug, and they're all gleefully stampeding and delighted that they've terrified this trapped bug. You know, I'm thinking, you mentioned about the visual effects there, Deborah. These are some, again, 25 years of visual effects evolution. Yeah. These things look great. You know, the bugs look fantastic. There's swarms of them everywhere. I mean, they were kind of, Phil Tippett's studio led on these things. The guy who did the ED-209 kind of big robot in Robocop, and the dinosaur supervisor in Jurassic Park. You'd have one job, Jurassic Park, and they all bring their A game in this stuff. You know, some of the stuff was it looks like it could have been released yesterday. You know, I mean, I don't know if you've seen the recent Amazon picture, The Tomorrow War, which kind of fits some of the DNA, complete, none of the satire of Troopers, but the visual designs are very familiar. They're kind of like completely alien things, just ready to mulch through these imperialist fascist pig dogs, it's disgusting and thrilling and weird.
Yeah, I remember as a 15-year-old watching it.
Yeah, this movie was shot at 15.
That bit when Neil Patrick Harris puts his hand on it and goes, it's afraid, and they're all cheering and doing cartwheel. I remember, that's the point I remember thinking, wait.
Are we the bad guys?
Are they the bad guys? I've just been cheering the bad guys the last 2 hours.
And that's, yeah, I think that's
it was
a
rated
really
15. Sorry.
Yeah, it score. Was.
Brown.
No, I think that's one of the key, that was my key takeaway, because like I said, there was all these different subliminal messages being fired at me, because this is the first time I've seen this big, you know, pretty long film, but also such a big budget film that's obviously trying to be, it's not your mainstream blockbuster. And this is why I was quite confused when I started watching it, because I was like, I was just expecting Space Wars and that's it. But yeah, right at the end, that's, and I think that that's maybe the ultimate sort of message was at the end when you realise, okay, definitely we've been cheering the wrong guys on for the whole of this film, and actually these bugs are probably just trying to defend themselves, or they just want to be left alone, you know. And I think that that's the sort of most important thing I think to take away from this film is that, and when it comes to fascism or it comes to politics, is a lot of people take a while to understand exactly what's going on before they say this is wrong. You know, if we look at any of the political struggles and anywhere really that have gone really, really badly wrong and really, really negatively, that it takes a long time for people to really fully understand exactly what was going on by looking back and things like that. So I think that that was something that I took away right from the end.
Yeah, they don't, if you look at it as being like a propaganda picture, they don't really spend much time trying to explain why the bugs are trying to destroy the humans. And it's just like, you know, in that sense, it's very much like a war on terror analogy, like they hate our freedom. What does that mean? Well, you don't know, you need to know what it means. They hate our freedom, that's all you need to know. Just, you know, they go and start shooting people.
Talking about subliminal messages, rewatching it again and taking notes, I noticed that the world's emblem was a sort of ego standing on a body, and it looked very Third Reich-y. And then in the different camps, like in the pilot boot camp and in the mobile infantry boot camp, there was also these sort of big eagle-like things like that, like sort of, you know, totems, I think you would call them. That's when I, rewatching it, first noticed, oh, that you can really see the sort of parallels to, you know, Nazism and stuff. And I thought that was quite subtle. But just when you were talking about the aliens, I loved the variety of aliens we got in this. It wasn't just one homogenous type of, you know, arachnid from, or was it Clithandu? I can't say it.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
Clendathu.
Clendathu, yep, right.
Big K.
And when they first drop from the starship, all the troopers, the big bugs that were, you know, shooting this plasma into the air out their backside.
Yes!
That was amazing, big butt blasters. I was like, that, just as an animation in itself, it was like, who came up with this? This is amazing. It was so brilliant. And then just all the different varieties and the sort of shock forces the arachnids had, and then, you know, the big brains and all that. But some of the best effects were a mix of CGI and actual sort of animatronics, because when Carmen gets captured and she gets stabbed in the shoulder, and that guy just had his brain sucked it. All they that was sort of, they sucked his brains out, and his acting and the goo and everything. Like, and you actually think Carmen's gonna save herself because she's this badass pilot now, and you're, you know, even though she's been sort of typecast as this really happy, she smiles all the way through the film. If you watch it, she's always smiling. You think, oh, she's gonna, you know, sort of, she doesn't need a knight in shining armor, and then Rico turns up and ruins her bloody victory. It really annoyed me, that one. But the actual visuals in it, as you say, it stands the test of time. It's really quite impressive in that sort of
and moment. Again, the kind of recurring thing with Starship Troopers, there is a couple of bits where like the special effects look terrible, but you start thinking, was that deliberate? Like, there's a bit where the guy that, the kind of farm boy that gets shot in the face, if you freeze that just before he gets shot, I mean, you might as well have just got a balloon and painted an eyes and a nose in it. It just looks so terrible. But again, you start thinking, well, what are they trying to say here? Is this deliberate that they've done that? And then you remember, well, it was the 90s, so maybe you can cut them a bit of slack that it slips here and there.
And I was a bit lost with, you know, how they're trying to say, well, what year is this being set in? Because it's filmed, you know, filmed in the mid-90s, and obviously talking about the future and things like that. Because right at the start, they're drawn on those computers, which obviously look really, really dated now.
But it's just sketch. In the future.
it's like basically like an Etch-a-Sketch thing. And I was just like, that really threw me, because I was like, are we really in the future? Are we? Yeah, of course, it's what the future would have been, you know, in 1997.
23rd century, it's set.
Yeah.
Oh. Was it Blade Runner? What's it, 1982? What's it, they tried to imagine the 2009, 2017, and, you know, obviously didn't get anywhere near it. But in 1997, that's what the future would have looked like from there. It's kind of... I'd defend that, you know, like it's and you look at Alien, for example, these space truckers, and they work in you know, really, really incredibly primitive computers that fill rooms. But even so, it's the, you know, this is kind of it's set dressing, and it's only marginally effective, I guess. The thing about this that strikes me most, I mean, you were saying about all the messages that are getting thrown at us, is the movie as a plot is kind of a desperate push to clear out bug strongholds. It's kind of, in and of itself, it's pretty dull and senseless. You know, violence is kind of made mundane of sorts. It kind of plays absolutely straight. No real clever sights, you know, for the audience to pick up on, other than the slathering of very funny satire. But there are no characters, you know, real characters to channel experience through. No one, you know, to distract from the overall kind of comedy message. No one to kind of really ask the viewer why they have to, you know, sit through this melodrama. And to find the violence meaningful, but they kind of think that it's weird. It's kind of like we're here to see the fireworks. We're here to see the kind of us to get to the fireworks factory, and then realize, oh, Poochie's in the way.
It's like none of the characters really question what's going on, so it doesn't encourage the audience to do that either.
There's one character that did though in that picture, and it was one of the guy who was you know, doing vox pops
very briefly.
The troopers. Yeah, it was very brief. You know, he was kind of talking about why they're going there, and maybe a let live and let live policy might have been better. And then Johnny just grabbed the microphone and he says, "I'm from Buenos Aires," and I say, "Kill them all."
Yeah,
and squashed right away there.
Yeah, the host just looks into the camera and he just kind of rolls his eyes a little bit.
There was a lot of exposition delivered in the form of sort of newscasts, mm-hmm. and I quite liked a lot of their graphics. Like some of the first opening scenes is like video. I liked when they went live to the invasion. I thought that was quite, the video really clever. Was like this.
when you think that this was like before like the Iraq War and things like that, mm-hmm. where you did mm-hmm. have like embedded reporters and things like that who were just dressed and just looked like they were in the military. I'm not aware. I don't know if that happened in the previous Gulf War or anything like that. So that
is something
they did.
Yeah, foreign correspondents.
Yeah, BBC had foreign correspondents all over the place, and it's kind of
like
that.
Yeah, but were they embedded with, like, the troops? I think that was quite a new thing in the 2003 when they went into the Gulf War. That was a real sort of effort by the military to control the kind of media narrative by, instead of trying to just keep the media away, they sort of embraced them a lot more and brought them in.
All the footage from World War II, the kind of landing on the beaches, there is precedent for this kind of stuff, even from the dawn of photography, of documentarians just going along with the troops to kind of to capture the stuff. But the thing about bringing it live was the real twist, I think. You were absolutely right, Deborah. I mean, the thing that strikes me about that, of overall, I mean, the kind of the little media interludes of sorts, mm-hmm. is that it's very much like how you would... I don't know, YouTube, for example.
Yes.
You do YouTube, but you click on and you click on. Would you like to know more? Would you like to know more? Yeah, and you can just imagine people kind of being radicalized in that kind of way. You know, to be spoon fed this right wing scary fascist propaganda, and how they're, you know, this becomes normal, absolutely normal. And as you said, nobody at all questions it. And I think to myself, maybe that's kind of really the reason why, is because people are spoon-fed this throughout their entire lives. And, you know, it makes the horrors inherent in building a democracy, almost democracy-free zone, where everyone's equal, only citizens can vote. It's kind of, wow, my God, how did we get there? Oh, right, okay, yes, we're... As Gramsci might have said, you know, full-on cultural hegemony.
Mm-hmm. And I think the two people that were challenging that sort of narrative was Johnny's parents as well, because they didn't want him to go into the, and sign up. And I thought that was quite interesting as well, that, you know, you've got because generally in these types of sentences, it might be perhaps younger people that might be more critical, and I say that loosely, but... it was the parents that were saying, oh, you know, you really need to think about, you know, getting an education, doing this, you know, don't sign up to that, you know, don't put yourself at risk and all that kind of stuff, and being critical of how the military was being used and recruiting in schools. And I think that's really interesting, because that's something that
we've seen, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, have been really critical of the military going into schools to make it seem like it's cool and fun and playing with these big guns, because that's what the adverts were sort of like, wasn't it? And I think that it was interesting to see that coming from the parents. And then, you know, because the dad was also really critical of the teacher who was really into the military and things like that. So I found that was one thing that as well that stood out quite early. And I thought that in itself is interesting, because in most cases, or in most, in a film, normally they would kind of play on the stereotypes of older people and younger people, and it would generally be turned on its head.
It's also interesting as well that the way the parents' sort of objections were sort of dressed up as in just wanting to keep their son safe. Mm-hmm. I wanted to know why they were happy to be civilians, and I wanted to know, you know, did they think that they should be able to vote? But they just, again, it's just something that the film doesn't pursue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they were rich.
They were the bourgeoisie, yeah.
They didn't mind because they were rich.
But even the bit where they're kind of all showering together, they're all talking about why they want to be a civilian. And again, if you're going to mix pornography, well, not pornography, it's naked human bodies. They're not fucking or anything. But
not at that point.
No, not at that point. I mean, yeah, the movie tries to make fascism look sexy, but at the same time, they're actually discussing why they want to be in politics. I mean, I want to have babies.
Yeah.
And it's easy. I want to have babies. License. He's there to get his education, you know, because he can't afford it. He's there to get, no, the
one of the women wanted to be a politician, yeah.
Want some responsibility over society. And that is kind of, again, it's the way that the world building is kind of dressed in throughout this picture is kind of really interesting. You know, beyond watching it again to cheer for the bugs, watching it again just to kind of pick up on all the kind of this world building that's layered into the script. It's like, again, like Robocop, like also written by Ed Neumeier. It's one of those pictures that kind of does reward repeat viewings, even if you can.
Definitely.
Even if you skip over some of the really, really eye-rolling, terrible melodrama.
Yeah, I think I would definitely pick up on a lot more, because I honestly at one point felt that my brain was just being like, just like a scattergun of all this information just going on, and I was like, ah.
Yeah, I mean, because it's like there's all these important things, but they sprinkle them in the periphery, and you're kind of like not sure where they want you to look. And when you're watching the film, you're thinking, wait, was that important? And then they don't really come back to it, and you think, that seemed interesting, but apparently we're not pursuing that. It's back to the love triangles.
There was some bits of the film, I know we say it's a pretty dumb movie, there was some bits that were quite smart, like when they were in the flight school and they're talking about plotting trajectory through space and changing the courses and things. Like, I think there was some consideration given to that.
Well, in that bit, all I could think of was, what can the computer know? What's wrong with your computer?
You've seen their computers. Their computers are etch-a-sketches. Even though they can organically suspend a human being that has been declared deceased, by the way.
And then repair his leg in 3 days.
Yeah, put on one of the casts that with LEDs on it to fix broken bones. I mean, I liked some of the stuff that they projected as, you know, the 23rd century. Like, their football was weird, really.
Still sponsored by Adidas.
More like gymnastics than anything else.
I know. I liked it. I'd have a go at that game.
Has anybody read the book?
No.
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 None of us have. Oh, okay. That's going to get anybody who listens to this rising up and say, you ignoramus.
Well, if anybody wants to make a reaction video to what we're saying, we're happy to get the exposure.
Next month, we're going to start Ungagged Book Club.
Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. I read it when I was about 13, and I haven't picked it up since. Sorry.
I remember reading a bit about the book at one stage. I think it's supposed to be a lot darker than the film. Yeah, I think that sort of 90s fluff is obviously not there, I don't think, in the original book. So I can imagine it can be a much kind of darker story without that sort of brightness to sort of offset some of that.
Can we talk briefly about the costumes?
Fire away.
There wasn't many, but I did like when you mentioned the sort of Nazi styling, it was very like that. But there was one thing that I did notice, that a lot of the sort of unisex uniforms they're wearing look like our police uniforms nowadays. They were quite on the money with that.
it was very much, I mean, that was kind of a thing that RoboCop did really well. I keep on bringing this bloody movie back. I mean, they kind of really saw urban policing and how it would evolve over the next 40 years. I mean, 40 years of Reagan's neoliberalism unfettered, and how it would need more and more defending, and what the cops would end up wearing what's real armor and you know, shock troops and a lot of that stuff. I mean, now we've got robots that can dance soulfully now, and it's kind of like, okay, that's going to be fun right after the shoot non-lethal bullets at protesters, or you know, we can maybe do a Fortnite dance straight afterwards.
With all the plasticky elements of the set design, the guns, the vehicles, everything, I got a Demolition Man vibe. There was a bit of familiarity there. But the characters as well, they're all the, what was his name? Is it the commander? Wait, let me check my notes.
We mentioned Clancy Brown. I love Clancy Brown, like from the Kurgan and Highlander. But he's one of the actors that no matter what he plays, he just comes off as like a badass. But in a very similar vein, there's Michael Ironside. Well.
Yeah, that's who I was thinking about. In Total Recall, wasn't he? And he was in Top Gun. I think that's why I get the 80s vibe.
Michael Ironside, I think, just has been Michael Ironside in every single thing I've ever seen him in. Yeah. I'm sure
I love him for it.
Yeah, I mean, he plays it better than anybody. Nobody else could play Michael Ironside as well as he can.
I think, see, back in the sort of late 80s into the 90s, even into the noughties, there was a lot of typecasting, and that's what I picked up really early with Denise Richards as well, just being that sort of vacant, staring, intense, really intense. And she's like that in Wild Things and Drop Dead Gorgeous and all these other films that she's in. So it's you know, not just the male characters, it's some of the female characters being typecasted as well and being regurgitated into very similar types of roles in different films.
Yeah, Denise Richards plays happy Denise Richards and evil Denise Richards. That's kind of her range.
That is very much it, yeah. And we love them both.
We do. We absolutely do. Just no more Bond movies, please.
No.
Yeah, I watched a YouTube video and it mentioned her character. Let's say do you think she get 97%? That's when they decided she should be a rocket scientist in the Bond film.
Yeah.
We love you, Denise, honestly.
I liked how you spoke about the film in acts, Scott. I thought that was quite good because it really seemed to be a new act, like that happened right after Buenos Aires was.
It's kind of divided up, and like every time you see a kind of a media interlude, it's kind of like new act.
Mm-hmm. And they upped the ante as well. Those sort of vox pops, because they started off, you know, quite innocuous, just informative, and then. You know, you see that one right after Buenos Aires has been destroyed and it's Wayne's crushing cockroaches and a woman manically laughing. for no reason.
And the bastards kill the dog.
That was the bit I remember watching as well, where I'm starting to think, you know, I'm not sure about these people. Like when the kid stamping the cockroaches seems a bit kind of unnecessary.
I'm doing my part.
And then them all laughing about it. And then the women absolutely losing their mind laughing. Is just, that's when you realise, like, there's something not right in this, underneath the surface here.
And then Neil Patrick Harvey, he turns up in one as well. He's telling you how to, you know,
how to kill a bug.
And that's another wee bit of foreshadowing there, because when they're on the battlefield and they don't hit his nerve, what was it that he called it?
The nerve stem.
The nerve stem, yep.
That's another thing. They should have gave them far better weapons. Yes. I mean,
you ever win
this war when you have to use that many bullets to kill one foot soldier?
Yeah.
Although they had like nuke grenades.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it was weird that was a wee bit that annoyed me. Actually, I wanted to know more about the technology they had. Like they would talk about going in a warp. And the star drive, but they never really told you about what that meant. And anyway, and that's just me.
They leave that for the bugs. They leave the kind of the giant plasma weapons, you know, farting fire into space to the bugs. And which that's is brilliant.
Right at the start, I remember you're looking at the map and it says, "This is Clintathu, and this
it's
is
on the other side of the galaxy." Like,
it would literally take millions of years for them to throw an asteroid that far. And literally, the idea that they would be able to get it and target it is just ludicrous.
and also the speed at which it would need to travel, it would turn Sir Isaac Newton into the deadliest son of a bitch in the galaxy.
This review's got off a highbrow. We're talking about physics. And...
I am so lost.
Brian's like, what?
I'm so sorry.
Can we go back to talking about musicals or something?
Well, let's talk about Basil Poulder's movie score. I mean, we're talking about, this is full of, it was very, you know, lots and lots of brass, lots of marches, lots of drum beats. You know, it's kind of, that movie knows it's a big fascist piss take. You know, a big militarism is, you know, like it, the marches, the brass fanfares. You've probably seen his other famous stuff like Conan the Barbarian and The Hunt for October, I think he did as well, and Robocop. But the thing that stuck with this one, it kind of blends a lot of this of World War II kind of movies, you know, like what Patton and what have you, the kind of breezy breezy march themes, and also, you know, like the thing about war movies is that, other than, you know, like the thing that I've got two things thoughts thinking at the same time is that other than like the year following Saving Private Ryan, this war movies are incredibly jingoistic, you know, in general, and that really kind of just delved deep into this one. I mean, this was kind of the last war movie to my mind that, before Steven Spielberg and Saving Private Ryan, rejigged the entire visual and oral design of cinematic combat. You know, there's kind of the pre Saving Private Ryan era and the post Saving Private Ryan era, and this one's very much a kind of a, you know, of the past. You see Saving Private Ryan replicated later on in Black Hawk Down and almost every other, you know, subsequent historical war movie, and how it replicates you know, the visual language of its time. So Troopers is kind of a simultaneous throwback, you know, as per using the fascist art of Leni Riefenstahl and Frank Capra and his Why We Fight documentaries. It uses the cinematic language of the past to kind of project a terrifying, horrifying vision of the future. And that we haven't changed much in 300 years to the movie maker's mind.
Yeah, again, yeah. We mentioned the costumes, and it is that bit, it's like a crescendo building towards fascism, like when Neil Patrick Harris walks out at the end and wears like a Gestapo uniform with the badges changed, basically.
And he's a fully fledged psychic scientist, isn't he?
He was a colonel.
Had he been commissioned as a colonel as well at that end scene? I'm sure somebody called him a colonel.
Yeah.
It seems that they stripped away this picture, gender equality, what's racial equality, and what have you. But they very much kept the state at the centre of this, you know, like about who gets to decide. You know, they've kept the political dimensions of oppression, but dressed it up in this kind of jingoistic civilian. What's it, the people who defend the society and those that freeloaders? Mm-hmm. It's different. Yeah. It's kind of a different kind of You know, we say patriarchy, all the various flavors of oppression that we presently suffer under capitalism. But they haven't got rid of them; they've just kind of sidelined it. You know, we're not really going to interrogate them in this picture because propaganda. It might have been an interesting thing to have all read the book beforehand as well to talk about this stuff. But alas, we didn't. Too bad. Sorry.
There's the whole way. You do wonder how a society like that would function without an enemy to fight, like.
Yeah,
you know, exactly.
What would happen before, you know, presumably before they'd contact with arachnids? You don't get the sense that it's a universe teeming with alien life unless the humans have killed them all, which I suppose is possible.
There still is some human conflict, like between the characters, like between Rico and Xander, and when they have a fight in the bar, and you don't mix with Fleet. And yeah, so I think they still have an element of the human conflict, but it's always just sort of resolved with a.
The state's the ultimate arbiter of these things. I mean, Rico basically says mobile infantry doesn't make stupid troopers. You know, before he disregards rank. You know, the state and the military structure is the ultimate arbiter of how you resolve these political conflicts, and the guy at the top, you know, wins is the ultimate dictator of such.
And I think that it's a really important point that Debbie was saying, that we don't know how long this conflict's been going on for, because we're actually, when we're introduced to the conflict, we can just tell it's in the long, an overarching conflict that's perhaps been going on for a long, long time. But we don't know how they got there and why they got there. Like, you know, were they, you know, what's the sort of basis for this conflict, and where did it come from? How long has it been going on? And why is it particularly problematic? We don't know any of that. And I think that that's perhaps, from my understanding of the film, is that they, because it's that sort of propagandist perspective, that doesn't matter. So it's almost like, well, they're the enemy, and this is why, you know, because they're going to kill us, and, you know, they're really, really dangerous, and so we'll just keep fanning this war, but we'll not actually give you any of the information to do it. So, you know, because in a normal sort of war film, you would at least get some background context from the two different countries, or, you know, where did the conflict come from? But then even to some extent, you know, if you look at the UK state, and when we go into any military conflict, we don't know the sort of ins and outs of it. You know, it just boils down to one really, really simplistic thing that happened, one event that somehow justifies the state to decide, well, you know, we're going to pursue military intervention. And, you know, and it can go on for years and years and years, as we know. And then you can see how these characters have ended up in this conflict, where they don't fully understand where it's come from. They don't really care where it's come from. It's, that's our natural enemy, and that's where we're going to, you know, continue and move forward.
What's that, Brian?
Yeah, like you get the sense that this isn't the beginning of the conflict. This is a sort of, this is it ramping up, as if it's something that's just been in check and bubbling away slowly. But when you build your whole society on the military and fighting, you know, it makes you think, did the humans actually create the bugs? Because that society seems like a society that needs to be fighting somebody. If it didn't, you know, people start saying, well, why do we need to be all based in the military when there's nobody there for us to fight?
Mm-hmm. And also, bugs themselves, we know that bugs are really, really important for our infrastructure and ecosystem, yet that's not spoken about either. So has there been a shift in climate so much that, you know, they've come up with that technology that they don't need the bugs anymore, things like that? Because I just think that bugs, you know, that the right-wing commentaries, people like Kate Hopkins referring to refugees as cockroaches and things like that. There's that in the head. But also the importance of bugs in our current climate is completely overlooked. And I just think that was something that I noticed out of all of the bits of information I was getting. I was like, you know, bugs were just seen as like a really simplistic way. Yeah, like vermin, basically. Yeah. They were just vermin. But they were never discussing the importance of it. And they were focusing on certain types of bugs, obviously these aliens, cockroaches being stepped on. But they didn't talk about bees, they don't talk about the infrastructure. And I just thought that was really fascinating how that was not even mentioned.
It's almost like when you're at war, your enemies are always bugs.
Yeah, that's basically. Vermin, yeah.
I've never seen a war film that has a big element of psychic and telekinesis. What is it called? Telepathy?
Yeah. And there's no explanation about that. I remember expecting some kind of explanation for that, and it's just not. It's just a fact of life in this universe.
Just Neil Patrick Harvey staring at you very hard.
Neil Patrick Harris.
Harris, sorry. Who's Neil Patrick Harvey? Sorry. Always calling people different names. When Neil Patrick Harris is just staring really intently at Rico, making him think about a card in that weird chair, and he had to press a button. That was never... There was nothing. It was just, this is
it's
a
just
thing.
There. And it was like, why are they playing pontoon? I don't know what's going on. Do you know what I mean? And this is where, that was the point where I was starting to get confused. And I was like, this is going to be a difficult 2 hours for me.
Well done getting through it, Brian.
Yeah.
I'm into that. But yeah, your point, Brian, about the war being forever, it's kind of, it really cements that for me, to my mind. I mean, it's kind of a fascist regime, violence is your common currency, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Without war, without horrors, without that, without brutality, I mean, the reason for existing kind of vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what's it, we're talking about the director, Paul Verhoeven, he kind of, he's spoken about this. He's kind of, he's made war movies in the past. Soldier of Orange in particular, which is about occupied Holland, where he grew up in the Netherlands during World War II. He kind of saw this stuff firsthand of bodies of resistance fighters being shot in the street and left to rot as a warning. I mean, he kind of knows this stuff really well about how you know, people will gobble up this kind of the way things are because it's the way to survive. this movie doesn't lecture you. That's one of the things I quite like about it.
Yeah.
This movie is kind of like, it's kind of brushed over this, about this, the society is, has its horrors dipped in the background. You know, it doesn't,
yeah, and I feel like I needed that lecture.
Fair enough.
You see, I mean, that's like, and it's very much like, in our world, you know, like there's all kinds of horrors going on in our world all the time, and we all just got on with our wee sort of routines that we call life. And you know, somebody comes in and looks at it, and you're like, there's these horrors going on in Yemen at the moment. You know, we've got a climate crisis, yet we're all just quite relaxed about it, and this is the way things are. You know, like, can we go on with what we're doing just the same as the characters, casually talking about how, well, of course, you don't get to vote unless you've served in the military and you've earned it, because people don't question their own reality.
And that's very true, particularly in America. The fact that if you're incarcerated and you come out, then you've lost, they take the vote off you, you know, so you're no longer worthy, you know, whereas in certain countries, like in Scotland, they've introduced voting for people. And then the reaction to that.
Prisoners.
Yeah, so prisoners are allowed to vote. And the reaction to that is quite fascinating, because it's almost similar to what we saw in that film of people saying, they're just shirkers, and or they don't deserve it because they've not, you know, they've lost their liberty or whatever, however you want to frame it. So these types of things already exist, particularly in America. It's a lot more overt in America. And we've seen it in the UK where Boris Johnson's like, oh, we need ID to vote. It's just putting barriers in place for people to access democracy, which should be, you know, if any changes are going to be made, it should be to widen access and not restrict in any way.
Yeah. A kind of light-hearted example that I noticed a while ago of the way people accept the reality that's presented to them and struggle to think of an alternative is, I think it was New Jersey, if not, it was another state in that sort of American Northeast. It was the only state that legally would not allow people to pump their own gas, like a self-service petrol station that everywhere's got. And you should have seen the outcry for people online when they were getting told, right, we're doing away with this, you know, self-service petrol stations were allowed. And people were, like, freaking out. They were saying, like, how can this possibly work? Some people were like, I'm not trained how to use a petrol pump. Other ones were like, yeah, exactly. What happens if I try to use it and I completely cover myself in petrol and I go on fire? And you're like, that doesn't happen. There is another reality in the whole world outside of this. Not even your country, your state, where that is the normal. But you have grown up with a slightly different normality, and despite the fact it is completely different from everywhere else, those people cannot imagine any other way of doing it other than the way they've done it.
It's like when you look at like going to school at a certain age, right, where it just becomes accepted, right? And then, you know, Green Manifesto, we're going to move it to 7. People are like, what? I started school when I was 4 or 5. Like, why on earth would you take education away from people? Why would you steal it from them? And it's the same thing, where it's like, well, you can change that. It's not, you know, we haven't changed the age that you go to school for, you know, since my grandparents were at school. So why on earth, you know, like, why can't you change that? It's just really, really interesting that.
And people can't answer that when you say that. No. When you say, well, what's your reasonings that you think 45 is a perfect age to start school? And I'm like, we've always done it like that, and it's worked fine. Like, it's just people are so tied to these sort of details that they're familiar with.
I think that those are both great examples, and I think that's quite evident in the film about them just being normalized into this behavior in many different scenes, whether it's the shower scene where boobs out, bottoms out, all the rest of it. They're just
no willies.
You know,
it's all very Austin Powers the way they cover up the willies.
Apparently, there's some side cock at one point,
is there? Oh, I need to look for that.
Must have missed that.
Trust you, David, to see the side cut.
Well, I was clearly keeping my eyes.
Trust me to miss it.
Yeah.
And just the way that it evolves into all these kids in the high school, which I still can't get over that these 30-year-olds are in high school. But anyway.
Casper Van Dien was 29 when he played that role.
Exactly.
That's because they started school at 8, that's why.
They are very beautiful and youthful, but the way they have, you know, they go from, what is it, Rico's journey is, he's a enlisted private, a listed man, just, and then he's a non-commissioned officer. He's made an officer on the battlefield, isn't he?
Yeah,
and then at the very
corporal,
end.
And then a sergeant.
Yeah.
A lieutenant, I think he has by the end.
And the same for Carmen, she goes through that as well. And then she goes for the, you know, she's a co-pilot on the flight team, and then she's the first, I don't know the terminology, sorry. What is it? Did she become a co-pilot?
Yeah.
In the final battle scene, yeah. And then she's a badass.
A captain.
A captain.
A crazy pilot.
Yeah, and she's, you know, she is quite a badass character, even though she's just this sort of ditzy, smiley.
And it's like
person.
They're promoting them as, you know, these great heroes, like mm-hmm. Captain such and such and Lieutenant. And it's like, they don't mention in the propaganda films the reason they get promoted was because everybody ahead of them gets killed. You know, every promotion in the film is because the
troopers are absolutely merciless about that.
Get their head cut off, you know.
Yeah, it's just not, you know, it's so normal for them.
And all these promotions are done in a really informal way as well. It's not like they apply to go up a gear or whatever. They mm-hmm. don't apply for it. It's just because somebody dies and they're like,
he's dead.
Here you go. But it's interesting that, you know, there's no like, I applied to go from corporal to such and such. It's just sort of...
Yeah, there's no studying involved.
It happens. None whatsoever.
There's a bit in it that I remember, again, when I was 15. And it's when when they're all having their sort of their party, when the guys get his violin and stuff like that, and they're throwing the footballs and drinking.
Yeah.
And Michael Ironside's character says to Johnny Rico, don't give up a good, I can't remember the exact words, don't pass up a good thing.
Never,
talking about Diz. And then he walks in the tent and Rico's in bed with somebody and he's shocked at first. He's like, who's that with you? And I've always thought, my initial reaction was, it was like homophobia. Fuck. But I was thinking, is it homophobia? Is a second there he thought Johnny was in bed with a guy? Because when he realises it's Diz, suddenly he's fine with it. He's not bothered about who the troop's shagging. And there's no really any reference to LBGT stuff in the movie that I saw. And I always wondered that. Is it just a sort of... Is there camps somewhere that everybody gets taken off to?
There was a wee sort of nod when Dizzy first arrived at the boot camp. And the two women are sort of saying, mm-hmm. "Oh, yeah, Brian saw it too. Yeah, Gaydar, bing, bing, bing." but the women cadets were sort of eyeing her up, saying, "Oh, mm-hmm. she's going to go far," sort of thing.
Totally messed up.
But I think it's more of, well, I mean, I could be naive here, but I think it could be maybe more of the time of when it was made, maybe because because there's not. If you look at these particular sort of action films, is any form of way to talk about action films, that there was not a lot of queer representation in these films at all. So, you know, perhaps that could mirror that.
The director, I mean, Verhoeven's made movies very, very prominent. And when he's a filmmaker in Holland, he made graphically, you know, sexual pictures. Mm-hmm. The ones that burst to mind are Turkish Delight and Katie Tipple, and The Fourth Man in particular is, you know, full on queer. It's and Spetters, which had Rutger Hauer and a whole bunch of them, and there was a kind of a pretty graphic rape scene. Men and men, you know, he's not averse to that kind of stuff, but mm-hmm. maybe it was the cultural when he moved to Hollywood. It was kind of like, okay, maybe this is a bit it was one of the few areas in the movie which was kind of surprisingly tame.
Yeah, well, it was 1997, wasn't it?
So, of course.
Friends was LGBT friendly.
Yeah, exactly.
Friends used LGBT representation for laughter.
Yeah. Yes.
I got married to a pregnant lesbian in the first episode. Fuck off, honestly.
No, but I'm just saying that was, the environment of the time.
We hadn't evolved beyond treating LGBT people as anything other than physical figures of fun or camp idiocy.
But then, of course, that's coming from a Hollywood or from a US perspective, because you look at some of the films that were coming out of Australia, so Priscilla at the time, a couple of years before, and, you know, like sort of more sort of feminist sort of comedies like Muriel's Wedding and things like that too, that wasn't about this typical narrative of the saviour, the man. So, you know, I think it's more just an American thing, maybe, rather than...
And certainly, again, big Hollywood summer blockbusters were tended. They were aiming for a sort of particular demographic, and I don't think they really factored LGBT people into that at that stage.
No, on the radar. Because I wasn't going to see it when I was 15, so so maybe that's why. I was down the road watching Priscilla.
I nearly mentioned it earlier, but that was a 15 certificate when it came out.
Yeah,
aye.
It was operated to 18 when it hit home video, but it was the first 15 certificate movie that I actually ever went to see, and I was open mouthed. What the heck is this?
you know, you've got, I mean, decapitations, nudity, like, I still gore. Think that.
Real gore. Yeah, like,
people getting bitten in half.
Their brains sucked out.
I mean,
melted to pieces in fire. It was kind of, oh my God.
Yeah, I was
loving it.
That bit with the bug, that was horrific.
When the woman's arm just melts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'm baffled at how that got a 15 certificate.
But there's no real sex. There's very little swearing, you know, blah, blah. The only stuff...
There's a couple of sex scenes in it.
Okay. There's a bit where Johnny's kind of like having his face blindfolded, and he's teasing out a kiss, and it's kind of a little bit sensual, but, you know, that's about it. I mean, if you look
there's
at
not them, much how, swearing I, either, well, is there's there? Not,
I mean, if you, again, you look at the shower scene, everybody's talking about one another. Nobody's checking one another out. You know, I'm talking about a bunch of teens that are mostly just out of high school. They would have been fucking.
Yeah.
Now, they've been checking out one another, you know, these buff, beautiful people. I'd have been pouring my fucking eyes out. It would be great. Yeah, okay, I'm just going to shut up there.
Don't have a communal shower with Scott, anybody?
I won't need a shower, Rod.
Well, I'll take that off the to-do list then.
Yeah.
So I mean, I do remember, like, that's just something that I always remember thinking about. Like, why is Michael Ironside so shocked when Johnny Rico's went and done the exact same thing that he just told him to do?
Also, who takes a violin into battle to play
on your
dinner break?
Like, these tough sort of, you know, military types, yet apparently the guy's also a classical violinist in the side.
Jake Bussey learned how to. Learned from Paul Verhoeven's wife how to play the violin, and he was adamant that he'd get that in the film. So he does it twice. You know, he does it in the he plays on when Rico's sending a message to Carmen, and he does so later on when they've defeated the bugs and everybody's triumphant and he's kind of bringing on the love scene, that kind of stuff.
But it's just that kind of it just feels very incongruous with the character. But then I suppose that's what people are like. You know, people surprise you. Okay, I think the last time we gave, was it March 2010 or March? No,
March
2005.
Yeah. But you're allowed decimal points. Rachel started a precedent.
Yeah, we don't encourage it, though. It's not banned, but it's not encouraged. Just 1 to 5. Brian, this was your first ever viewing. Can you have seen it before? Mm-hmm. What would you give it, March 1 to 5?
Oh, I don't know.
How many grenades?
How many grenades would I give it? See, because the thing is, I've actually enjoyed talking more about the film than I did actually watching the film, which I think is quite interesting. I think it's a lot to do with the fact that I'm not really into action films, sci-fi films, any of these types, or blockbusters in general. So it's not really got much going for it. So I'm going to go with 3 out of 5, which I think is harsh, but I'm going to just say it.
Deborah?
Well, I've got a wee summary written down. I said... sexy, slimy fascists. green goo, orange goo, insect goo, but a private will find a violin to play a concerto after a big fight. I gave it 3.5 stars. Half star just because I think I really like it, and the 3 is because you need to watch it at least 3 times to really appreciate it. It's full of satire. It's full of some really... you know, things that are currently topical in political discourse, you know, whether it's, you know, about citizenship or should you have babies and things like that, and the whole militaristic vibe. So 3.5 stars, I'd recommend it, but you need to watch it a good few times to fully appreciate it.
Scott?
It's a movie that kind of reinvents itself, becomes ever more prescient as we move forward. You know, the vision of the future is clunky occasionally, but at the same time, the way that... you see our society in lots of ways. I mean, the one scene that I'm thinking of we didn't really cover was the little bit in the media breaks where it's like on the BBC where you have two opposing arguments and they're all just shouting over each other. Yeah. Like, that's it.
Question time thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was good. That was great. I thought to myself, oh my God, did they realize that was going to be replicating Fox News? It was going to be replicating BBC Question Time as politics gets ever more polarized within the ever shrinking Overton window. I mean, this is a fascist society, yes, but they will still have little arguments within that sphere. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're asking me for a rating. I think this movie is prescient. It's lovely. It's well made. It does what it says in the tin. It is, and it keeps on giving. It loses points because, you know, the love triangle is dog shit. I mean, RoboCop is a five-star movie, five grenade movie, five giant fart and bugs movie, because one, the movie works perfectly without, even if you're not getting all the satire, it works as a kick-ass cyberpunk action flick. But this one loses a lot because the characters are dull, really dull, and the story is kind of dull. So it loses a lot of points if you're not looking for a rip-roaring comedy. But if you're going to peel away the layers, there's a lot to reward you in this picture. I think this is four giant grenades, four flying bugs out of five.
Four giant butt-blasting bugs.
I love them.
Yeah, that scene that you mentioned with the sort of talking heads, I remember thinking that seemed ridiculous the first time I saw it. It was like, I remember thinking, people don't act like that in the news. Like, that guy's a clown, the way he's wittering on and no listening to the women. It's like totally normal now. It was so ahead of its time. I'm glad you mentioned that there, because I would have remembered that after we'd stopped recording. And
you'd have kicked yourself.
Wanted to come back and do an outro to talk about it. In terms of my score, I would probably give it 3 out of 5. There's a lot about this that I like, but I'm still so unconvinced unsure of what to actually give the makers credit for, because there's so much in here that I'm really still 50-50 in whether it's as clever as I think it is or whether it's a complete accident and I'm reading too much into it. So all things being equal, it definitely deserves to get a passing score, but I'm not convinced it deserves anything more than a 3. So that's my score, 3 out of 5. Well, thanks everybody. I've enjoyed this. I think we're still a bit learning the structure for these Ungag Film Club episodes, but we're managing to cover things so far, so I'm quite enjoying it. Thanks for joining us.
Well done, David. Scott, thank you very much.
Great having you. I'm sure we'll have you back again at some point. Deborah, always a pleasure. Brian, you're always here.
Thank you. Anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
So if you want to catch up in our last episode of Ungag Film Club, you'll find that at leftungag.org, and we covered the film Pride. The next film we're going to cover next month is August, which in Scotland means it's back to school. So we tried to go for something with a connection to school days. And it was Deborah that suggested this one, which is The Blind Side. Did I get that right, Deborah?
Is that the one we're doing? I thought that was for sports.
Aye.
But all right, we'll do that back to school.
Sports is me. Ages to go before that.
That's very sad. Oh, so I thought you said side. Sports is me, and I was going to say that's what he said. I'm like, I was ready to fight
May, because that's when they give out the trophies.
Oh yeah, all right. Okay, so do that again. With Blind Side.
The blind side.
I almost watched Sandra the wrong Bullock film for this. I kept saying Battlestar Galactica. I was watching that, and you're like, no, we're not doing that one.
I just imagine you trying to get through the 5 seasons of Battlestar Galactica in a few
hours. I've done it twice.
You just spent 2 hours on Starship Troopers. So next month we'll be reviewing the Sandra Bullock movie, The Blind Side. We look for something with a school connection, and because August is back to school month in Scotland. So I hope you can all join us to see that. Catch us every week on Hollywood Ungagged, and any articles you can find on leftungag.org. And I think that's all we've got time for.